Coming up Saturday morning at 6 on Hometown Heroes. As the world marks another anniversary of December 7th, 1941, we'll hear from someone who was there at Pearl Harbor on the USS Pennsylvania.
They got a message that I had been killed in action.
Thankfully, that message was erroneous. This Alabama native survived that and some more close calls, and he'll tell us all about it on Hometown Heroes. Saturday morning, 6 a.m. on Power Talk 1360 and 1280.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, whether it's West Coast, East Coast, somewhere in between, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who have done remarkable things and endured some crazy situations for the sake of our freedom. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, oftentimes inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And every year about this time, I like to focus on something that America vowed to never forget. December 7th, 1941, a day that has lived in infamy. And we're going to hear from a man who was there at Pearl Harbor that day. But we're going to start before that because Russell Winsett grew up in Hamilton, Alabama. Tell me about Hamilton, Alabama. What was it like growing up there in the 20s and 30s?
Well, there was a little farm town. About all we had there was farmers. We had a few merchants that run the town. I went to high school there, Hamilton High School. Played football and basketball there. I was 20 years old. I says to my dad, I'm going to help you get this harvest this crop, and I'm leaving. I says, I'm going to service. So me and two buddies went to Birmingham, signed up. Went for a physical, I got turned down. I had albumin of the kidneys, whatever that is, I don't know. But anyway, they sent me home, and those two guys went on. And believe it or not, I never seen or heard from them again. But I heard that they both got killed in action. But a week later, I went back for physical, and I passed, and I went right to Norfolk, Virginia for my boot camp. And after that, it's all history.
I guess so. They assigned you to a ship. What was that ship called?
USS Pennsylvania. It's a battleship.
And folks maybe have read about the Pennsylvania or heard about it. It was there in Pearl Harbor on December 7th.
Right. We were in dry dock, and they strafed us and dropped a couple of bombs. We lost quite a few men, but I survived, and I was on a machine gun.
Well, tell me about that ship. What? Because this is the first ship you've been on. I mean, here you are. You grew up on a farm in Alabama. I imagine there weren't a whole lot of big battleships around Alabama.
None at all.
So what was it like being a young man and getting used to this big old hunk of iron?
Well, everybody else on there was in the same boat. most all of them were new ones. But I got accustomed to it pretty quick. It didn't take me long.
Did you think that war was coming? Were you prepared?
I had no idea. I don't think anybody did.
How much training had you guys actually had on the defenses of the ship?
Oh, we had training every day just about.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of training did you receive? What were you prepared to do?
I was on a machine gun.
50 caliber?
50 caliber machine gun. Mm-hmm. I was up on the foremast because, as you know, the Pennsylvania had two big masts. And I was on the foremast in a nest way the hell up in the sky. And it had stops on those guns so you couldn't shoot the guy next door. And it only had a certain area you could shoot.
The range of motion was limited, so
right.
You couldn't inadvertently
right.
shoot your own ship, sure. So you got into the Navy thinking, hey, this is a good way to earn a living. This is going to be an adventure. You weren't necessarily thinking, hey, there's going to be a battle to fight at some point.
No way. And I wasn't even thinking of retirement.
And I'm sure once you got to Hawaii, That was a pretty fun place for a young man from Alabama to go and see.
It sure was. I loved it. But, you know, it's funny, the correspondence between my parents and he's a second cousin of mine, a guy by the name of Pope, last name is Pope. He lived over there with his wife and two kids. And he was on a ship. He was out at sea when they hit Pearl Harbor. But the family was okay. And we had a lot of good times together, touring the islands and all. It's real nice. I loved Hawaii.
Kind of lead me into how that all unfolded from your perspective on that Sunday morning. Had you been up late the night before?
Well, our Liberty was up at, I don't know, 10 o'clock or something at night. But since we was in dry dock, we couldn't use the facilities on the ship. We had to go out on the dock. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, I went out there to shave and shower and change clothes and all. That's when I walking down the dock, I heard the siren to go off, battleship, man your station. Mm-hmm. And that's when I rushed aboard ship and went up to my machine gun nest. Lo and behold, ammunition boxes were locked. And I said, I'm not going to climb that ladder back down and back up to get the keys. So I took what they call a dog wrench. It was a pipe about this long and broke a lock. Lo and behold, some young ensign in the Navy, he wanted to put me on report for destroying government property.
He didn't think Japanese planes coming overhead and bombing you guys was a good enough excuse. Huh?
Right. So, anyway, the captain saw that what the report was, and he just shook his head, told it instant, beat it.
So you heard the signal for general quarters. You get to your machine gun. Had you seen planes in the sky? Did you know what was happening, or was this just chaotic?
Well, I could hear a lot, bombing and everything, guns shooting, but I had no idea what was going on.
Mm-hmm. I've talked to some Pearl Harbor survivors who said, you know, their impression was it was exercises. It was some kind of practice that the Americans were doing.
Right.
But you had an idea from all the noise you were hearing that this is for real.
This is for real because where we sat in dry dock was up above most of them in the water, you know. You could see a lot, but I knew it wasn't no drill. I knew it was for real.
So you man that 50 caliber machine gun. You bust open the ammunition box so you actually have something to shoot at them. And then what are you shooting at? What are you seeing as you look out on that scene?
Well, actually, I couldn't see too much because you had a band around you to hold you up to the gun. And I couldn't see much except when the plane would come in my scope there. I didn't know what was going on. I could hear a lot, and it was pretty scary.
As far as what that looked like, the number of planes that were coming through, or how much time you had to react if you actually saw something, I imagine there's probably nothing that could prepare you for that.
Well, you figure you see two or three come over and are strafing, you knew there's going to be more, so you just sit and wait for them. That's all we can do.
How close did those planes come to where you were?
I'd say some of them 100 feet, come right over the bow of the ship.
You could see markings on those Japanese planes?
Oh, yeah. I could even see the pilot with a Japanese grin.
You could see the face of the pilot?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know that was a long time ago, long, long time ago. What did that feel like to be in that situation? Because now we look back and everybody knows, well, Pearl Harbor happened December 7th, 1941. But I can't imagine the feelings that must have been going through you because it was so unexpected for you.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. Believe it or not, I never got scared until it was all over.
Hmm.
Because it really didn't have time to get scared.
How long do you think you were there in that position continuing to man that machine gun?
Oh, probably a couple of hours.
Did it feel like longer?
Felt like all day.
Yeah, I bet. Did you come close to hitting anything?
Well, I could see it because on these belts that was ammunition was in, every fourth one was a tracer, so
right.
You could see where they were shooting. And I don't know if I sank any planes or not, but shot any down, but I sure as hell hit a lot of them.
So you could see that you were scoring some hits.
Right.
And if you're firing away at this gun, I know the whole purpose of them being there is firing at you guys too.
Right.
How close did some of that incoming stuff come to where you were?
I really couldn't say because most of the damage was in back. I was up forward and it was in the back of the ship, and I don't really know what damage was done back there.
Well, I imagine you're so dialed in on trying to see what's in front of you and fire some ammunition that way that you don't have time to look back.
That's right. That's right.
And you just said that you didn't get scared till it was all over.
Right.
How did you know it was all over?
Well, they sound the alarm. It was all over.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I climbed down out of my machine gun nest and went down below and saw them bringing people by that was in stretchers and all. It was pretty sad.
Had you gotten to know many men aboard that ship?
At the time, actually only people in my division. Because there, if believe it or not, if you were caught outside of your division, that guy put you to work. So we stayed pretty much in one compartment.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew quite a few people, and most of the people in my division I knew. Outside of that, I hardly knew anybody.
I bring it up because I'm just curious if you lost anyone that day that you had become acquainted with.
Oh, yeah. A friend of mine, he was from Orlando or somewhere down here in Florida, and he was the ship's photographer. And he had climbed up a leg of the mast. It had ladders on it, and they climbed up there to get pictures. And they shot him right off, killed him. That hurt me bad.
When did you start to grasp the magnitude of what happened there that day, not just with your ship, but the entirety of
it? Well, really, that happened about 8 o'clock in the morning, so after that, you had time to look around, and I'd say a couple of hours, you know, you could see the damage had been done, and you knew there was a lot of lives lost because those ships rolled over and were bombed and everything. A lot of people lost.
Can you paint a picture for us of what it looked like from your vantage point as you scanned the horizon, what you could see?
Well, it'd be kind of hard to describe, but out across the bay, or channel rather, we saw ships laying close to each other, some collapsed, some on fire. It was quite a deal there.
You could see smoke in the air?
Oh, yeah. Smoke and flames, and you could smell bodies burning. That wasn't good.
And I imagine that lingered for a while. It took a while to clean
all that
up.
Oh, yeah.
What were the hours and the days, maybe even that week after that attack? What was that like to be there for all of that? What kinds of things did you see and experience?
They kept us pretty busy trying to get the ship back in ship shape. And they had our ship in dry dock was almost completed. All they needed was to put two screws on. They did that and flooded the dry dock, and we got on underway a week later and went back to the States.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever wondered, I mean, I just think about the ships that were sunk that day, those ships that were on Battleship Row. I'm just guessing that had you guys not been in dry dock, you would have been on Battleship Row?
That's right. Either they're out at sea, so I guess we were pretty fortunate.
Could have been a lot worse for the Pennsylvania?
Oh, God, yeah. If we'd have been underway or tied up there in the docks, we'd have been a lot worse.
What was the hardest thing for you to swallow as you saw and heard the stories and smelled that you just described and soaked in all these different things there in the aftermath of that attack? What was the hardest thing for you to come to grips with?
Well, the loss of life, mostly. That was hard to take because I thought that could have been me as well as those guys, you know.
Sure.
That was pretty hard to swallow.
How did it make you feel about the enemy?
Hatred. And it's still there.
I imagine there were a few things said about that among the ship's crew.
Oh, yeah. Lots.
Everyone that, you know, that wasn't at Pearl Harbor that I talked to, I asked them how they found out about Pearl Harbor. And most of them say, well, we heard the president's address on the radio. Did you guys hear any of that?
No.
In the years since, when you hear that speech, you hear the resolve reflected in that speech and the determination that this is what America's going to do. How does that make you feel?
Well, feel pretty good when they figure they're going to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And believe you me, we did something about it.
You sure did, and I want to hear about it, but it's time for our first break. When we come back, we'll listen to some of President Roosevelt's speech from December 1941, and we'll explore more of Pearl Harbor survivor Russell Winsett's experiences in World War II. But as we head to these messages, how about a taste of a relevant song that was pretty popular 70 years ago, courtesy of the Sammy Kay Orchestra.
History in every century records an act that lives forevermore. We'll recall, as into line we fall, the thing that happened on Hawaii shore. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. We will always remember how they died for liberty. Let's remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory.
You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 94-year-old Russell Winsett of Bonita Springs, Florida. On December 7th, 1941, he was aboard the USS Pennsylvania, which was in dry dock at Pearl Harbor. We heard him remember ascending to his duty station, a 50-caliber machine gun nest on the foremast of that battleship, and how he fired away at Japanese planes going by. The Pennsylvania was one of the first ships to return fire at the Japanese that day, and Mr. Winsett knows some of the rounds he fired connected with enemy aircraft. 24 men aboard the Pennsylvania were killed that day, many more wounded, and Mr. Winsett knows he easily could have added to that number. We're thankful he did not, and thankful he can share his story with us on Hometown Heroes. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find photos of Mr. Winsett and also of his ship in the aftermath of the attack. That might help you understand all of this even better. Before we're done, we're going to hear briefly from his son, Ron, who was in the room throughout this interview with his dad. But right now, before we dive back into Mr. Winsett's World War II memories, let's listen to some of what you would have heard if you were listening to the radio on December 8th, 1941, when President Franklin D. Roosevelt addressed the nation about what had happened the day before at Pearl Harbor.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
So that was FDR on December 8th, 1941, rallying a nation that had been attacked. Let's get back to one of the men who experienced that attack firsthand, Russell Winsett. You told us about the events of December 7th as you saw them that day. But what happened next for you?
After I got off at Pennsylvania, I got on another ship and went to the Pacific. Of course, this is getting away from Pearl Harbor now, but that ship got blown in half, and I survived that.
What ship was that?
USS Foote.
The USS Foote. What kind of ship is that?
The destroyer.
So you went from a battleship to a tin can.
Right.
And how'd you feel about that? Because, I mean, you're on a battleship and you get hit at Pearl Harbor. Now you're going even to a more vulnerable ship.
Well, actually, it's a lot better because you got acquainted with more people.
All right.
And a battleship was so big that you just couldn't get a, didn't know all of everybody on there. A destroyer was more family-like, you know.
Mm-hmm. And what were your duties on the destroyer?
Same as a battleship, gunnery.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I was second or third class. But cleaning the guns and taking care of them.
Mm-hmm. I guess you must have had pretty good aim, huh? You must have had pretty good eye.
Oh, yeah. Then I did. Not so sharp today.
Were you one of those squirrel or possum hunters growing up in Alabama or what?
No. The old man kept us too busy doing chores around the farm.
Okay, so you're on a destroyer, and you're still, your duty station is still a machine gun. Where did you guys go, and what kind of action did you encounter? Because I imagine you were pretty hungry to find those Japanese.
Oh, yeah. Where we got hit was, and this destroyer was in a battle out at sea. We had bombarded a few islands and coming back south, and we got word that there's an enemy task force heading south. So we made a U-turn and went back to meet up with them. And we went in for a torpedo run, and that's when we got hit. They towed us back to the dry dock, and they put a false stern on and towed us to the States. Then I got on another one, and I went all the way up, and I was in Iwo Jima. I saw the flag raising there.
Hold up, because I want to hear about this incident where you guys got hit. Because you just say that, we got hit. I think before you said we got blown in half. You're saying that real matter-of-factly, but I'm sure that wasn't a no-big-deal situation when it happened.
Oh, no.
Where were you, and how did you experience that?
Well, believe it or not, I didn't have a particular battle station on that destroyer. I was, like, any gun had a problem, they'd call, and I would go there.
All
so
right.
I was back and forth. And believe it or not, I had just been down below decks before he got hit, just coming up the ladder when we got hit, and I lost a whole gun crew down there, and I just made it myself.
So you say you lost a whole gun crew, and some people might be wondering, well, how many men is that? What does a gun crew consist of?
Actually, it wasn't the gun crew. It was the magazines where the ammunition was stored. That was four or five guys that are loading the ammunition into the hoist to go up to the guns.
And you were coming up the ladder. How close to that?
10 or 15 feet. I could feel the blast myself.
Yeah, that gets your attention, huh?
You better believe it.
So what do you do from there?
Well, I went topside and got over where it was clear. And I forget if the executive officer or captain one ordered to abandon ship. And I got ready to go overboard with the crew, you know. And before anybody had jumped in the water, they belayed the action. So we stayed aboard. A good thing we did, because what they did to compensate for the half of the ship being blown off the back, they flooded all the forward compartments. So everybody on the ship lost everything they had from water and what have you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we went up forward and got the ship ballast up. And of course, we were close to land anyway in the channel there. And they sent a destroyer out to tow us to the beach. Then a tugboat come and got us and towed us back down to Espirito Santos. They put us in dry dock there and put a false stern on. Well, actually, all they did is just take they had torches, just cut it, make it even, and put big sheets of metal up there and welded. And then they flooded the dry dock to see if we would float, you know, and everything was on, no leaks. So it was a merchant ship, I think, towed us back to the States. And I got off of that one, and I got another one.
Well, I'm just thinking, what if I were in your shoes? What would I be feeling? What would I be thinking? The first ship I'm on gets hit by the Japanese at Pearl Harbor. Quite a few casualties there. Then you get onto this destroyer. They hit you again, almost sink the ship. You almost had to abandon ship. You're a few feet away from a blast that easily could have killed you. I'd be starting to wonder if I was going to survive this war. Did you ever feel that way?
Well, I said somebody was looking over my shoulder.
And some people say, well, that's a cliche, but I hear you say that, and I don't think you say that lightly.
I tell you, I guess you heard the old saying, a cat had 9 lives. I think I had 10.
That means there must have been some more close calls out there for you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Give us a taste of another one.
Well, we went into, that's the only time my ship ever got hit.
Yeah.
But, like I say, we was in Iwo Jima, Okinawa, and then went in the invasion of Japan. And
what ship were you on for that?
It was the USS Auburn, which was a communication ship.
Boy, that's an awfully... awfully bad name for a ship if you're a Crimson Tide fan like you.
Yeah.
I know Bear Bryant hadn't hit Alabama yet, but was that as big a deal back then, the Auburn-Alabama rivalry?
No. Nobody even heard of that place.
Good thing that was the case, because if you'd been assigned today, you might have said, no, I need another ship.
Huh? That's right.
So you mentioned something there. You mentioned Iwo Jima. And, of course, just like Pearl Harbor, where your war experience started, that is one of those names that the second you hear it, the image people think of is that flag going up atop Mount Suribachi. Did you see that flag flying up there?
I sure did. We had taken troops in, because we could take about 600 troops. And we lay off offshore, as close as we could get, and let those guys go in. And I'm up on the forecastle of the ship and looking. I didn't even need binoculars to see. Of course, you didn't know who they were, but whether Army, Navy, Marines, or who. But they got the flag, and they had to bring it down and put up another one. I don't know what was wrong. I never did get the history of that. But raised the flag twice. They brought wounded aboard, and they had... I'm up on the quarter deck, and the boat pulled alongside. It had a body in it, and... looked, and here was a Japanese they brought aboard. He'd been wounded, and they got him, I guess, to try to get information. Laying alongside him in the stretcher was this M1 Garand rifle. I said, man, that's American rifle. Here he had probably killed some guy and took his gun. Well, I got that and put it down in the armory and left it there.
Was that hard to see? The soldiers that were brought aboard that were wounded?
Well, it hurt, but, you know, you got used to it after a while.
Well, you started to tell me that story about taking the rifle from the wounded Japanese soldier who was brought aboard your ship. And you said you put it down in the armory, and I was wondering if you were able to hold on to that thing.
Oh, yeah. But that ship, when we left the Pacific, we came through the canal and pulled into Philadelphia. Well, those Marines at the gate, boy, they searched everybody for everything. So I knew it was going to be tough getting it off ship. So I broke it down and took piece by piece off. And got away with it. Then I got everything home. I put it back together, and he still has it today.
Still in the family.
Yep.
And this was an M1 that was probably used by a Marine on Iwo Jima, probably a Marine who got killed.
Right.
That's some significant history.
Never knew who it belonged to, who it was issued to.
You mentioned the fact that there were two flags, and the story goes that the first flag went up, and the ranking naval officer looked up, saw that flag, wanted it for himself, and said, we need to send a bigger flag up there. So he sent another patrol with a bigger flag, and it's that second bigger flag that is in all the famous photographs, the Joe Rosenthal photo, and, of course, the statue in Washington, D.C. at the Marine Corps Memorial. But for you at the time when you looked up and you said you didn't know who put it there, but you knew what it was.
Right.
You saw the red, white, and blue. You knew this
right.
was the American flag. What did that mean to you to see it on that high ground of Mount Suribachi.
I knew it. We had captured that island. It wouldn't be the normal Japanese up there to fire at us, you know. We get close enough in, they could fire on us from the beach. That was pretty damn close for a ship.
Mm-hmm. Was it hard to be gone that long, not knowing how long this war is going to last?
Oh, God, yeah. Not knowing what happened back home or anything. Because out there you didn't get mail every day.
How often did you hear from home?
Oh, about every week, I guess. When we get someplace, the mail catch up to us and we get a letter from my father. In fact, in my room there, I have a letter that I wrote to my family before the war. And they saved it. Then when they passed away, my oldest brother and his wife kept it. He finally got back to me, and I said, man, look at that scribbling.
Takes you back a ways, huh?
Yes, it does.
So you were in from the beginning of the war to the end of the war.
I was in from August of 1940 to August of 1960.
Yeah, 20-year Navy career. And as far as World War II, you already mentioned that you went into Japan at the end of things. So you're there at Pearl Harbor. Your ship, the Foote, gets hit. You see Iwo Jima. You're there at Okinawa. You go into Japan after the surrender. Throughout all that time, was there a moment, an incident, an experience that for you, when you think back on it now, you say, boy, that was the worst, or that's where I came the closest to not being here, to my kids and grandkids and great-grandkids not being born?
That's right. Yeah, I often think of that, but I guess the good Lord is looking out for me.
I guess so. What was the scariest or most frightening, most harrowing moment you think of all of that for you?
I guess Pearl Harbor is the worst. Because, see, most of these other battles, we would just bombard. And some of them would fire back and some didn't, but that was the easy part. But you often wonder, what the hell happens when you run out of ammunition? And that came across my mind several times out there. But luckily, we never did.
I imagine if you spent that much time at sea, from the start of the war to the end of the war, on one side of the Panama Canal and the other and all over the world, you probably had to encounter some pretty ridiculous weather a time
or
two.
Oh, God, yeah. Typhoons. Oh, there's a hell to ride on a small ship.
Yeah, I had one vet one time describe that to me as feeling like a flea on an elephant.
That's a good description.
Well, can you describe for us what that was like? I mean, what to be on a small ship in a typhoon, what that meant for you guys and how crazy that was?
Well, he always figured the old man, the skipper, he knew what he was doing and he knew how to ride them things out. And I was never scared during a hurricane or typhoon, but he got some nasty ones out there.
How bad? I mean, if you were on the deck of that ship, what would you see?
Well, you see waves as high as a ship, and boy, that was scary.
Mm-hmm. And if you were below deck, what did you have to do to avoid getting thrown from one side to the other?
You just hold on to whatever's there.
It almost seems like that might be scarier than some of the combat situations.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
It's time for a break again. There was quite a bit that Russell Winsett survived in World War II. His three sons, seven grandkids, and seven great-grandkids sure are thankful for that. If you want to see what this 94-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor looks like, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And keep it right here because Hometown Heroes will come down the home stretch right after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with a Pearl Harbor survivor as we mark yet another anniversary of that day which has lived in infamy. 94-year-old Russell Winsett of Bonita Springs, Florida, a native of Hamilton, Alabama. He spent 20 years in the Navy and another 15 years wearing the uniform of the U.S. Postal Service. And every December 7th, he puts on his Pearl Harbor Survivor's hat and honors the more than 2,500 Americans who died that day. The war started with you climbing up to your machine gun nest on the foremast of the battleship Pennsylvania, firing at Japanese planes, but I want to talk to you about how the war ended. Almost 4 years after that, here you're fighting this enemy. Now this enemy finally surrenders. What did that feel like to know this quest, this mission that you and 16 million other Americans have been on was finally successful?
Well, it really felt good to know that we had won. That was the main thing. God, boy, if we'd have lost that war, God knows we wouldn't be here today probably.
Do you remember some celebration with your fellow sailors?
Oh, yeah. We raised hell aboard ship, and then we all went ashore. Look out.
You don't look like a guy who could get yourself into any trouble.
Well, I never did, really. I got away with it.
Well, I don't want to have you incriminate yourself with anything. You mentioned that you stayed in for 20 years. What made you want to do that? What was so special about the Navy that you made a career out of it?
Well, it wasn't so much as special. It was the fact that I didn't want to go back to the farm.
So it was better to get shot at by the Japanese than be on that farm, huh?
Right.
Boy, what'd they have you doing on the farm?
Everything. Anything is to do, I did it.
I know that you've talked about this a lot. Your son's a teacher. You've been to his classes over the years. Before he retired from that, talking to students, I know you've told your story a lot, and I'm sure you've given some thought to why it's important that people know about December 7th, why it's important that we remember the more than 400,000 Americans who died in World War II. What is so important about that? Why is that something that you talk about?
Hopefully, the United States will be prepared better than they was before, and that's the main thing. Always got to be prepared because you don't know who's going to hit us or when.
Mm-hmm.
It's good to be prepared.
As part of that 20-year Navy career, you spent a few years in the 50s stationed at Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, over 4 years.
Uh-huh.
But they went about business like if nothing ever happened. A lot of the residents in Honolulu was of Japanese descent, you know.
Yeah.
And you had to be on the lookout because you never know.
Have you been to the Arizona Memorial?
No. I left there. It was built after I left there, and I've never been back.
I'm sure you've had people ask you if you wanted to go and try to get you to go.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Why not?
I just have no desire to go back.
Too hard to relive that?
Right. The older you get, the more tender-hearted you get, I guess.
What about the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C.? Have you been there?
I went there about 4 years ago, I guess, yeah.
What'd you get out of that experience?
Brought back a lot of memories. It's very educational, to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm. What'd you learn on that trip?
Well, mostly just be prepared.
Mm-hmm.
That's the main thing. And I don't know if the United States is being prepared or not.
I hope we don't have to find out.
Well, I hope not.
What was it about America during that time that you think made it so special or enabled America to win that war?
Well, I think we had one of the strongest nations in the world. We had to be strong or we wouldn't have been here.
Yeah.
And we have smart people running this country, or did have, I don't know about now.
Well, I want to say before I forget, thank you for serving our country. 20 years is a long time to do anything, but especially to be in the Navy. I know you spent a long time in the Postal Service after that. I don't know which uniform you liked better, but when you think back on your military career, what are you most proud of?
Surviving.
Wasn't always easy, huh?
That's right.
Sometimes I talk to veterans about being on this program, and I tell them the name of the program, Hometown Heroes, and they bristle, and they say, well, I'm not a hero. So many of you guys don't want to be called that. We think of you that way because we can't imagine going through what you went through. But when you think about World War II and all the Americans who served, who are the heroes in your mind?
Well, it's hard to say. A lot of them I don't have names for. But to me, a hero is a guy that could get off the ship and go ashore and fight on the land. Man, that hand-to-hand combat, I couldn't cut that, I don't think.
You saw a lot of those guys coming back to your ship at Iwo Jima, huh?
Oh, yeah.
When you were there on December 7th, you experienced that from your vantage point on the Pennsylvania, from your little machine gun spot. in all the years since. I'm sure you've read a lot, maybe seen some programs about it. What are some of the things that have been added to your understanding that really still kind of resonate with you about that day and everything that happened?
Of course, like I say, at 94 years of age, the old memory's not what it used to be.
Sure.
But I never, looking around after the bombing was over and the strafing, I was wondering why the Japanese didn't have troops to invade that island after they'd bombed it. And that's where they made one big mistake.
You know, that brings up a good point, because when we talk about this, we talk about what happened. So often we don't talk about what could have happened,
right,
or what you guys maybe feared would happen at the time. Because I imagine in those weeks after the attack, you guys didn't know that they weren't coming, right?
That's right.
Did you guys talk about that? Did you expect something else to happen?
Oh, yeah. Everybody had in mind that they would come in, even not that day, but maybe weeks later. We never knew.
Mm-hmm. What did your parents hear about what had happened there at Pearl Harbor?
My father, he turned gray overnight because they got a message that I had been killed in action. Now, who sent that message, I don't know. But as quick as I could, it cleared like a day later or so, I called home. That's when the old man really flipped out, you know.
So did you know they had gotten this message when you called?
No, I didn't know.
So you called home. What happened? Tell me about that conversation.
Well, my mother answered the phone, and I think she almost had a heart attack when she found out it was me. And then the old man got on, and he flipped out. He said they got a message that I'd been killed in action. I said, well, I don't know who sent the message or why, because I'm very much alive, a little shaken up, but other than that, I'm all right. But they said my father turned gray hair overnight.
Wow, how about that? I've heard of that happening, but mostly to people in combat. I can see how that news would do that to them. And I guess that's one of those 10 lives you were talking about?
Yeah.
And you had two brothers and two sisters. Did your brothers end up serving in the war as well?
My oldest brother did, yeah. He got as far as Hawaii himself. He's there for a few days, and I don't know what happened. He got a medical discharge. He really didn't see any action. He was only in the Army for a few months. And my younger brother, he wasn't old enough.
We were talking here a few minutes ago before we started recording the program that you just received a package from somewhere in the Midwest of pictures of your ship, the Pennsylvania, that they wanted you to autograph.
Yeah.
And I know you get, you know, requests every time December 7th rolls around. They want you there with your Pearl Harbor Survivor's hat on.
Yeah.
Because there's not too many of you guys left.
I really have no way of knowing because the national headquarters closed down.
They disbanded because there's not enough guys left.
That's right.
And I don't get the sense that you're ever looking for attention about this.
No.
You're not going around saying, hey, look at me, I was at Pearl Harbor. And probably sometimes it's not easy to get out there and listen to them read the names.
That's right.
Or go speak. Why do you keep doing it? Do you feel a responsibility to tell your story?
I do. I really do. I feel that my friends and neighbors and people I associate with like to know. And that's the only way you're going to find out, because I sure as hell don't volunteer for nothing.
But you do have the courage to say yes when you're asked to tell your story, especially if the one asking is your son. Your middle son, Ron, is here with us, and I'm going to bring him in for a moment. So you're a teacher, and you've seen firsthand what your father's story can mean to people who weren't even born when all this went down.
Absolutely. I taught school for 32 years in Willingboro, New Jersey. Dad was always there for us. He provided a good home, a good upbringing. He would frequently come into my classroom on December 7th. I would invite him in to speak to my kids regarding that day, and he would answer a lot of questions. And I think it was a great learning experience for the children. I do have cousins in Alabama that are also teachers. They have invited him into their classrooms, and he has given a firsthand account of the experiences of the day. We're very proud of his accomplishments and what he went through, and we do have a collection of memorabilia that we have on hand, and that's going to be family heirlooms to hand down to the kids and great-grandkids.
You talked about him coming in those classrooms. What did you see in those students when they listened to what he had to say and what he experienced on that day?
They were very attentive. And the types of questions, now, I taught fourth grade at the time, and the types of questions were, you know, as you might expect from fourth grade kids, they were, you know, did you kill anybody, that type of thing. And the way he handled the questions was quite well done.
And what's it like for you as his son to know how easily he could have been one of those who died that day at Pearl Harbor?
Well, we wouldn't be having this interview, first of all.
Yeah.
When I think back about what he went through and the things that could have happened, it's a sort of a scary situation to know that you may not even be here. But, you know, he did get through it. And like I said, we're all proud. And he raised a great family. And all the kids and grandkids are all productive.
Anything else you want to say about your dad?
He's a great guy. And I hope he hangs around for at least till he's 100.
Uh-huh. You guys ever arm wrestle?
No, I'm afraid he'll beat me.
Well, then I'm not going to try either. But I am going to come back to him now, because Ron and his brothers and all their kids and grandkids wouldn't be here if the Navy in World War II hadn't allowed Mr. Winsett to meet his wife, Anna. So let's get that story. How did you meet the woman who would become your wife?
At a receiving station in Philadelphia in 1942, I guess. We got out and roamed around the city and outskirts and all. So I went to this bar, and I saw this beautiful lady bartending. So naturally, I struck up a conversation and got a chance to meet her again and again and again, and that was it.
So you had to kind of work at this. You asked her out. She said no?
I think she said she was working.
Uh-huh. She kept giving you excuses, huh?
Yeah.
So you went for her sister?
I went for her sister.
And that got her attention?
I guess.
Did you get married during the war or not till after you came back?
I got married in 1942 during the war.
So you got married and then you shipped back out?
Right. A couple of days after I was married, I shipped out again, man.
That couldn't have been easy.
No, it wasn't.
And it probably made for a pretty good reunion when you got back.
Sure did.
What do you remember about that, about coming back to America? Because here you were there the day America got pulled into this war, and you were there when America won this war. So to come back to the States and step foot on American soil again and see your bride again, what did that feel like?
Well, it's nice because I saw a big old boy when I got back.
Did you know you were a father? Had you gotten a letter or anything?
Yeah, I knew she was pregnant.
Yeah, but you didn't know it was a boy or a girl or a name or anything like that?
No.
So tell me about that moment. What do you remember?
Well, he was 16 months old before I got to see him, I think.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was over a year. It was quite a thrill. And we made up for lost time because he came along, then his brother.
What keeps you going? You're 94 years old, but obviously you still got your wits about you.
I drink good scotch.
Uh-huh. That's the secret, huh? No one's ever told me that before. Well, and clearly the underlying statement there is that you need to maintain your sense of humor, and Russell Winsett clearly has done that. Today he's helped us put a name and a face on December 7th, 1941, and we thank him for that. Again, there are some photos of Mr. Winsett then and now on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page as well as hometownheroesradio.com. That's the program for today. I hope that you can join us again next time. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll hold on to what Mr. Winsett and any other Pearl Harbor survivor will tell you. Remember Pearl Harbor, keep America alert, and never forget that freedom is not free.